I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water, and we are going to open an organizational meeting for the purpose of introductions and adopting the committee rules. So why don't we begin with introductions, and if you would, Chris, tell audience and each other who we are and where we come from, and perhaps a little about the kinds of issues that you personally are interested in exploring in this committee or that are important to your district when it comes to the topics before us in environment and water. And I'll start down here with Representative Benz.
My name is Cliff Benz. I'm the representative from District 60, which takes in Malheur, Harney, Grant, and Baker County, actually just a small portion of Grant. It's about 26,000 square miles and has many, many water issues within it, most having to do with how people can keep using it. And my purpose in being here, I hope, is to assist in discussing any new proposals regarding the use of water. I was on the Oregon Water Resource Commission for 8 years, enjoyed chairing that for two of those 8 years, and enjoyed a great deal of discussion regarding difficult water matters. I am particularly concerned about Oregon's protecting its use of water on boundaries. I live in Ontario, and of course, we deal with Snake River issues all the time. And of course, we drive by the Columbia all the way as I journey here to Salem. And I wonder about our use vis-a-vis Washington's. And then finally, I am a lawyer, and I've represented many people in the Klamath. I'm familiar with the Klamath Basin issues, and of course, the challenges faced by everyone vis-a-vis California. And then finally, the ocean and all the issues that go with return runs of salmon and fish. I've enjoyed many discussions regarding those, and I look forward to many more in this session.
Thanks.
I'm Phil Barnhart from House District 11, which is Central Lane and Linn Counties. I have in my district several small municipalities, Coburg, Cresswell, Brownsville, Crawfordsville, and a couple of others. Every one of those communities has issues involving water and groundwater issues, especially groundwater pollution issues. Several of them are working on sewage wastewater treatment, in one case actually a collection system for wastewater. The city of Coburg doesn't have one, and it's in the process of being constructed now. So groundwater, water issues, even in spite of the fact that I'm in the middle of the Willamette Valley where there's a lot more water than Representative Bent's district per person, it still is an issue. It looks like Cresswell may have to actually buy water from Eugene Water and Electric Board out of the Mackenzie River, transport it across country in order to have any chance of expansion in their areas. I'm also extremely interested in a more general issue having to do with the way in which our economic activity and industry and transportation impact our environment, the way in which we use, in the way in which we pollute with greenhouse gases and a variety of other issues of that sort. And I understand some of those issues may also come up in this committee.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Vic Gilliam. I'm the state representative from just east of here in Silverton. My district includes Malala and Mount Angel. This is my second term. I was appointed. I have a great district with lots of great history. But I took Mac Sumner's place, who unfortunately passed away. But we have, in addition to Mac, we've had a number of great legislators, so it's quite a legacy out there. It includes people like Roger Beyer and others. I'm very interested in these issues. I think we've got a full plate almost before we start, just by virtue of the fact we use the words environment and water in naming this committee. To me, there is one resource, one natural resource, water, and all the others sort of are secondary to that. I know that everyone on this committee understands that. I appreciate Representative Barnhart's comments in that regard. You'll hear from me later about one of my passions, which is alternative energy, especially in the form of hydrogen and using hydrogen as an alternative source. And the chair and I talked about that and worked a little bit on it last session. I look forward to doing some more of that. Thank you.
Representative Boone, you want to?
Sorry, I'm late. I had a little other committee issue. I am Deborah Boone. I represent the House District 32, which is the upper left coast of the state of Oregon. And this is the permutation of the old half of the old Emergency Prep and Ocean Policy Committee morphed into Ben's old energy. Was it energy and environment? And so I'm glad to see that we didn't drop water altogether, and that's what I'm looking forward to working a lot on some water issues and some energy. So hopefully we'll get the energy. And unlike Representative Gillum, because nothing is like him, but I'm interested in ocean renewable energy, and so I'll be working on those issues too.
Great. How about down the line, Jules?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Jules Bailey from Inner East Side Portland, the Hawthorne and Belmont and Division areas up to the freeway. And my district is a special one that I think at least half the executive directors of all the nonprofits in the state of Oregon live in my district. So I would say that there's probably some concern there around a wide range of environmental issues and water issues. But to me, in my humble perspective, Mr. Chair, this committee is about balance and making sure that we are balancing human activity with ecosystem preservation, ecosystem management, and making sure that we have a legacy for our children.
I'm Bob Jensen, representative from House District 58. The motto that I have had in my seven now sessions in the legislature is that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. And if you don't know where House District 58 is, you would be advised that there's a very good bourbon now that's called the Pendleton Bourbon, so that it can place it for you, and maybe in that regard. If, as long as you remember specifically, what that commodity is for, it's that's the drinking commodity. On a serious side, there's just an incredible need that we have in not just this state, but in across the United States, and for that matter, across the world, as far as water is concerned. Water is fundamentally, the source of life. Without water, we run into some real pretty basic sort of problems. So we're going to have a myriad of problems and issues that we deal with on water in this committee, and I look forward to working on those issues in a very nonpartisan way, recognizing and understanding each other's we represent various districts in the state, needs and concerns with this topic, but recognize the other members have as equally important needs as they are perceived in their district. So it's going to be real challenging, and I think maybe even a little fun for us as we proceed through this session. So it's truly a pleasure for me, a privilege for me. It's a privilege for me to be in the legislature, and it's especially a privilege to be serving on this particular committee, which I see as fundamentally more important. You will excuse the bias showing through here, but fundamentally more important than any other single committee that exists in the Oregon legislature.
My name is Jefferson Smith, District 47, Gateway, Maywood Park, East Multnomah County. First exposure to water policy, or first awareness of water policy, was when I was briefly a cattle hand in your district in Hermiston, Oregon, as the son of a former rural DA, and working for a man who was on the board of the Cattlemen's Association, and it, you know, it sufficed for dinner conversation. After that, was fascinated and intrigued and confused by the topic in law school. And now, as it relates to my district, I suppose in I'd say in three ways. First, and try to answer your question, Chair Cannon, how will water environmental policy interface both with our urban and our rural citizens, as well as our even probably most quickly growing suburban citizens, which reflects my district probably more accurately than any other description? And how will it impact working class people? Second and related, how can we balance our rich natural resource history with the realities of a changing world, kind of reflecting some of what Representative Bailey was saying? And then third, how can we play to our economic strengths as a way to compete in the global economy? And how could stealing a page from people smarter and more senior to me, how can Oregon be a Silicon Valley of a green economy, I think is an interesting question that will at least have some interface with this committee. And the last thing I want to say is I was struck at a meeting, in fact it was on these issues, I got a smile on my face, not because the issues were easy, but because how privileged I felt even to be having the conversation. And there are people in this room in this very moment who know a lot more than I do on a whole host of things, and hopefully all of us will sort of approach this humbly and try to learn in our maiden voyage. And the very last thing I want to say is it's because there probably won't be another occasion. Oh, there might be, but I just want to say how much an honor it is to serve with you, Ben, one of the people in the world for whom I have the most respect, legislators and otherwise. And it is truly an honor to serve with you. And I'm it's moving to me to be sitting to your left today.
Thank you. Beth, we're lucky to have Beth Petrina, extraordinarily fortunate to have Beth Petrina as our committee administrator. Beth, you want to introduce yourself and our committee assistant, Sue?
Sure. I'm Beth Petrina. I'll be serving as the committee administrator for this committee this session. I worked with House Ag last session, and I've staffed a number of other committees over the years, but I'm very pleased to be here and be happy to working with all of you. And Sue Hampton is going to be the committee assistant.
Great. Well, we're fortunate to have your good services. I'm Ben Cannon. My district is smack dab between Representative Bailey's to my left and Representative Jefferson's on my district's right, and Representative Smith, Jefferson Smith's district. And I served on the Energy and Environment Committee last session, was vice chair of that. I'm looking forward to continuing some of the good work we did there around renewable energy, energy efficiency, and water issues. One of the real privileges of serving on this committee, I think, is our ability and our obligation to take the broad view to look at all corners of the state. And, of course, my district is an urban one, and my constituents know water mostly as it comes out of their tap. But one of the real joys for me of being in this building last session was learning about water and its use throughout the state, delving into the knotty problems that surround water law and its application, and trying to reach some sort of understanding about how we best use and manage this resource to the well-being of the state as a whole. And I really look forward to taking up that subject as well as others in this committee this session. We have an extraordinarily well-equipped committee, I think, to deal with these issues, and feel really privileged to be serving with all of you. I want to give you a few reminders, just technical reminders, about our committee rooms and for the audience as well. Of course, these are very sensitive microphones. We can just do what we do with them. We don't need to get right up in them. Cell phones, please off, because of the interference that they tend to create. To committee members, I really do hope that you will be at and expect that you will attend these committees. If for some reason you know that you will not be at a committee meeting, please let me or Beth or my legislative aide, Christy, know if you're not going to be able to make it. And my pledge to you is, insofar as possible, which I expect will be 99% of our committee meetings. We will finish by 5 o'clock. I have a young daughter at home who I know I'm eager to get to, and I'm lucky to live close enough to the Capitol to make that drive each evening. Not all of us are. But if we start late, I may be willing to finish a little late as well. So let's try very hard to be here at 3 o'clock. I know many members, if not most, are coming from other committees, and that can hold us up. But start on time, finish on time. Let me say a few additional words about my hopes for this committee. I really do buy the idea of the speakers and others that the knowledge that committees are really the engine of this legislative process where the work gets done. And I hope that members of this committee will feel open to raising issues, suggesting improvements, bringing forward alternatives for full and fair and open discussion of the issues in front of us. And I think that's especially true. That invitation to you is especially true to members of the minority party. I believe very strongly that your full participation will lead to better work. We will come out of here with better bills when you are fully and truly engaged in this process. And that principle of inclusivity is particularly important in light of the fact that some of the issues that we're going to deal with are issues that do not directly impact the constituents of my district in the way that they will constituents of other folks on this committee. We have extraordinary expertise when it comes to water. I think Representative Bentz mentioned it in passing, a former Water Resources Commissioner for many years, Representative Jensen, who was at one time chair of the House Water Committee. I intend to draw on those, and I hope that you will bring forward those that knowledge and experience as we deal with those tough subjects. Of course, there will be times when we disagree, and I expect that our disagreements will be civil, will be respectful, and that most importantly, we will keep open lines of communication about those disagreements and agreements. I'll be meeting weekly with both vice chairs of the committee and look forward to meeting individually with all of you as well to hear about your priorities, hear about work that you hope we can do in this committee, and work with you on scheduling hearings for bills that you may wish to discuss in the Environment and Water Committee. So really look forward to the next several months together. Let's do this. Let's have a motion on the rules and see if there's any discussion of the committee rules, which you should all have in front of you.
I move, Mr. Chair, that we pass the rule. I hope this is the right time to do this. The committee rules for the House Committee on Environment and Water.
Representative Smith moves to pass the proposed committee rules for the House Committee on Environment and Water. Is there any discussion?
I have some discussion, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some sensitivity to rule number 16, and my sensitivity has nothing to do with you, Mr. Chair, but I suspect you'd be willing to just elaborate a little bit on your commitment to 16 as it relates to manure reports. We have a new vehicle here that I'm not entirely, I won't say comfortable, but I don't entirely understand how it'll work. But I think its success depends on your commitment to make sure that any amendments that may or may not come forward are distributed, are discussed, so that if a minority report is in the offing, we have that opportunity. So if you could say a couple words about that, I'm sure they would be reassured.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Representative Gilliam. This is, of course, a new rule that all committees will be sort of trying to manage as we move forward. My intention is to, and my hope is to, draw on, as I said, the best ideas of the minority if there is a instance when we're unable to come to consensus on a bill and move it forward. I am I respect and recognize and support the minority report process as a way of bringing forward an alternative to the full chamber. This rule requires, to my understanding, that a prospective minority report had been adopted or drafted in LC form and distributed to members of the committee. My pledge to you is to ensure that those amendments are distributed when they're brought to the committee in a timely manner, which I think at Ideally, it means before the committee meeting, and even well before if possible, but recognizing that sometimes that isn't possible, and you come to the dais with them because they've just come out of LC. We'll see that those are distributed, see that they get on the record, and ensure, therefore, that a minority member is able to bring forward a minority report based on an amendment that was not adopted into the majority committee report. I hope that goes some way towards alleviating any of your concerns on that. The subsection B on 16 provides that if the work session has been scheduled in such a way that it falls so quickly after the initial public hearing that it's been impossible to get the LC amendments drafted, that in fact only we go back to our old rule of sort of having to have referred to the subject in committee and that being grounds for introduction of minority report. So,
as I suspected, good answer.
Thank you. Any other discussion of the motion on adopting the rules? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Bentz?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. The motion passes. At this point, let us open an informational meeting on water. And my intention is to stick with this subject at least for the first couple of weeks. I think we'll have some agency bills before us starting next week. We also have a bill that comes out of the Interim Energy and Environment Committee that we'll be hearing next Tuesday. What I asked today, asked Beth to help set up a really broad overview of water policy in Oregon and really water resources in Oregon, and knowing that this will certainly be old information to at least several members of the committee, hope that especially with the addition of some folks who haven't spent a lot of time with this issue in the past, that we would get a really broad overview of water in Oregon. So the questions I asked were sort of where is Oregon's water? How is Oregon's water used? How does the state of Oregon manage and regulate water, water quantity, water quality, both in a municipal setting as well as in a agricultural setting, as well as for industrial purposes. So we have some of our great agency staff here to talk to us about their work with water and hopefully begin to answer some of those questions for us. So I'll invite Phil Ward and Brenda Bateman from the Water Resources Department to kick us off. And expect to spend sort of the majority of the balance of our time with Phil and Brenda, but want to make sure that we leave ample opportunity for DEQ and DHS to talk about the way that they interface with water policy as well. So thank you very much for being here, Phil and Brenda, and whoever wants to kick us off.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I will kick things off, and for the record, my name is Phil Ward. I'm the Director of the Water Resources Department. And with me is Brenda Bateman, our Senior Policy Coordinator, and she will be the person doing our regular day-to-day work here in the Capitol. So we wanted you all to get a good look at her today as well. And we appreciate, members, this opportunity to talk a little bit about what we do, and I very much appreciate the expertise here on this committee, and certainly am reminded from Representative Jensen's earlier characterization of water, of what one of my predecessors told me, that the names of the first two water masters in Oregon were Smith and Wesson. We don't settle disputes over water relative with firearms very much anymore. We settle them with lawyers, largely. But we do, as a result of that, have a fairly significant legal budget at the Department of Water Resources, because water, by its nature, is certainly an issue that people occasionally disagree over. And so there are conflicts associated with this business. We wanted to give you a bit of, as per the chair's request, discussion about how the water process works here in Oregon. So we're going to talk about these things, and then, Mr. Chair, as you noted, we'll try and leave plenty of time for our fellow agencies to bring in their piece. But where do the supplies come from? Who uses water in Oregon? How do we manage it? What's Oregon water law?
what are some of our challenges, recent successes, and then some highlights that Brenda's going to give you in terms of where we hope to bring some different issues to you this session. So essentially, water in Oregon comes from that we use comes from two places, surface water and groundwater. Now, our surface water arises, obviously, from our rivers and lakes, and those sources come from rainfall and snowpack. And snowpack is a significant player in terms of water supply here in Oregon, and something we'll talk about a little more. Groundwater, it's interesting that our groundwater supplies, we've moved to using groundwater much more in recent years as a source of water because our surface water is in a little shorter supply than it has been. We have a couple different types of groundwater in Oregon. We have what we would call alluvial groundwater, so shallow aquifers fed directly by rivers and streams or that feed rivers and streams. And then we have a very old groundwater in Oregon. I guess you could call it ancient groundwater in the deep basalt aquifers that underlie the Pacific Northwest. And both those sources of groundwater are utilized extensively in our state by the citizens of our state. So here's how water is consumed in our state, or here's where it is consumed largely. And I need to note for the record here that this is water that's diverted and consumed. This is not all the water that the state produces. So when we show agriculture, there's the largest piece of the pie, about 80% of the water diverted, 88% of the water diverted is used by agriculture. That doesn't mean they're using 88% of all the water produced in the state of Oregon. This is simply the water that is diverted. So agriculture is the largest water user, followed by the municipal and industrial sectors in our state. So that is who uses our water. But here's another key water use in the state of Oregon that that has come more to the fore in recent years. And that is water in stream for fish and wildlife uses, for recreational uses, for transportation uses, hydropower, water quality. And we actually have statute in Oregon that allows several state agencies to apply for and secure in-stream water rights to protect some of these values. So we have a large number of in-stream water rights in place in the state that we protect just like we do a consumptive water right. How do we manage water in Oregon? There are a number of agencies that have a stake in the water business here in our state. And at first glance, you could look and see all these different segments of state government that are involved in the water resource issues and think this is a jumbled kind of situation. But actually, there are very clearly defined roles for the state agencies involved in water resource management in Oregon, and those are very closely coordinated through the governor's natural resources cabinet. And Brenda snuck in earlier in the week and took a picture from the last meeting of the governor's natural resources cabinet. So specific to the Water Resources Department, we are what you would call the water quantity agency. And unique, I think, to that particular responsibility is that there is no federal counterpart. So the waters of the state are truly considered, under law, the waters of the state. Now, that gets cluttered a little bit with federal legislation like the Endangered Species Act and things like that intersect with our own water law. But there is no federal counterpart to the Water Resources Department. And we're responsible for the allocation distribution of water throughout the state, and we consult extensively with other agencies like DEQ and ODF&W, particularly the Health Division, with these folks in our decision-making processes on water allocation. There are actually formal consultation requirements in law and rule relative to making our decisions relative to allocation. Water Resources Commission. We're governed from a policy standpoint by a 7-member commission appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And they are an active group that adopts all our rules and gives us policy direction. This is our mission, serving the public by practicing and promoting wise long-term water management with two co-equal goals. The stewardship of Oregon's water resource, as has been stated earlier today, we want a resource that's available for generations to come. And water supply, ensuring that there is adequate supply to meet Oregon's water resource needs. Here's just a quick slide on how the agency is organized. We have a technical services division. These are our science folks. The majority of our true science staff resides here, engineers, scientists, groundwater scientists that provide the data and the information base for our management decisions. Water rights and adjudications, these are the folks that you come to if you want to secure a new water right, and you apply through that division of the agency, and they're the folks that adjudicate adjudicate the allocation of water around the state, and we have several adjudications remaining to complete, most notable being the Klamath adjudication, which has been underway, I'm embarrassed to admit, since 1975. So we're near the end of that adjudication, but that's been a very difficult one. Our Field Services Division, the largest division of the agency, and these are the water masters, uniquely medieval type of title in some ways, but these are the folks that are in charge for distributing water around the state and ensuring the folks that have the right to use that water get it. And then, of course, we have a small group in the director's office that include Brenda and I. So Oregon Water Law, this is the 100th anniversary of Oregon Water Law, 2009 was its inception. February 24th was the day of adoption in 1909 when Oregon adopted its first water code and moved it from the Smith and Wesson era to the era of thoughtful government in terms of water resource management. And that law declares that all water is publicly owned. Some parts of the state, that does not apply to groundwater. Not some parts of the nation, that does not apply to groundwater. But in Oregon, all water, the entire water resource, is publicly owned. However, you can obtain a permit or a water right to use that water. And that water right establishes the date of that water right, establishes your priority of use. So we function under what's called the doctrine of prior appropriation, like nearly all Western states do. And basically that means first in time, first in right. And we're responsible for administering around 85,000 water rights statewide. So there are four basic fundamentals of water rights. Beneficial use without waste. So you can't have a water right and not use it. And you can't have a water right and use it wastefully. So the basic principle, beneficial use without waste. The priority date, as I just mentioned, determines your relative priority of use. And in times of water shortage, which is what the doctrine of prior appropriation was designed to anticipate, in times of shortage, then the folks that have that oldest priority date are the last ones shut off from use. A pertinency, water is tied to the land in this state. And so when the land is sold, the water right stays with that land. So there are ways to move water from one piece of property to another, but the general principle of appurtenancy, water tied to the land, is a key principle in Oregon water law. And as I mentioned earlier, you have to use it. You have to use beneficially water in Oregon every 5 years, and if you do not, that right is subject to forfeiture. There are four elements of a water right. The source of the water. So if you have a water right, it will specify these four things. Is it surface groundwater? Where's it at? The type of use. So is it agricultural, municipal, industrial, in-stream, etc.? The, the point of diversion, so where you get it, that might be a wellhead, that might be a spot on a river or stream, and then the place of use, as mentioned earlier, the land that right is attached to. Water law has evolved significantly.
I'm allowed to ask you to go back a slide and stay there for half a second.
I recognize Representative Smith.
Just hang on that side, just slide just a sec. I'm good, thanks.
Very good. And we can make these slides available to you, Representative, in hard copy if you would like. We've had significant evolution of water law in Oregon over the years. Until 1955, we did not have a groundwater statute in Oregon. It was essentially the rule of capture. If you could get it, you could use it. In 1955, the Groundwater Act, which authorized the state to manage groundwater as well as surface water resources, was adopted. And that same year, the legislature authorized basin plans, so it authorized the department to manage that water by basin. Another significant milestone in water management in Oregon, in 1987, the In-Stream Water Right Act was adopted, which has resulted in more than 900 cubic feet per second of water being legally protected in-stream here in Oregon. That is orders of magnitude more than any other western state has accomplished. And the majority of that water is what we would consider senior water, 1909 or earlier type of water rights. So a success story in terms of a piece of legislation adopted in 1987. And then an additional piece of legislation adopted, I believe, in the 80s, the Allocation of Conserved Water Program, which allows folks to take steps to use their water more efficiently and then spread part of that water to new land, and part of that water gets to go in stream as well. So how do we manage water rights? We do, as we mentioned earlier, have a core of folks out in the watershed that actively distribute the water resources. And you see a member of our staff taking a water measurement. But the principle in the graphic to the right is a key one in terms of water management. So a junior user, which might be up high in the watershed and have first access to the water coming down, if he is junior to the user below him, lower in the watershed, it's our responsibility in times of shortage to shepherd water past him and deliver it to the senior user wherever he's located. That, as you can imagine, becomes a source of occasional conflict for our staff.
Yeah.
So some key challenges, and we do want to note that surface water in Oregon in the summer months is nearly fully allocated. You see some exceptions there that are kind of focused around the Willamette system. But for the vast majority of the state, if you take Representative Jensen or Representative Bentz's neighborhood, we are not writing new water right permits in those neighborhoods for surface water.
And Phil, could you explain what you mean when you say it's fully allocated? I mean, there's some determination has been made of how much is available for allocation. What sets that standard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's an important question, because we actually began some years ago, before we would issue a water right, doing a water availability analysis as to whether there was actually water enough available for us to be able to justify putting a right out the door. And so we actually do a detailed water availability analysis relative to any water right application that we have. And before we issue that water right, if our staff does not believe that there is water available today to serve that right, then it is not issued. Now, in the past, before that water availability analysis was in place, essentially the state issued the right, and the prior appropriation doctrine was the mechanism used to deal with shortage. But it became very apparent to us some years ago that there needed to be a water availability analysis, and we do this now both for surface and groundwater before any right is issued to eliminate the false expectation syndrome.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Ward, could you just briefly describe what, when you said you must basically use it or lose it, but once every 5 years, what constitutes the use or a use?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, a very good question, because we would not consider running a garden hose out once every 5 years into a field as beneficial use without waste. So it has to be a legitimate use of the water for the purpose of which that right was intended. So that might be the irrigation of a field. There are going to be times when you don't irrigate every year. You might be changing a cropping pattern, something of that nature. But once every five, you have to make sure to legitimately use the water for the purpose that the right intended. So irrigation or some other use of that nature. But again, that has to be a real use, not just running a hose out onto a piece of ground.
Follow up.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you. And how is that determined?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be the call of our local water master. So if that becomes a question, and that has become a question in the past, then our local water master would investigate and ascertain whether they felt that use was real or not. And as you can imagine, that decision has been litigated in the past.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure it has.
So here is the opportunity for future water development in Oregon, and that is the development of winter water. Now, that I say that with the caveat that there are winter water needs for our fish and wildlife and other resources. So when I say that there's unallocated water in the winter in most of Oregon, that's true, but again, that availability analysis has to be done site-specific, so that we can ascertain that any, for example, environmental values that need to be taken care of through winter flows are taken care of. But truly, we look more to winter water today in terms of future water resource development. We do have, amazingly, in Oregon, we consider ourselves a wet state, obviously, and by the way, I would apologize for our December deliveries. We overdid it a bit, and I did have to apologize to the Director of Transportation the other day, because he suffered a little bit on the roadways in terms of the December snowfall. But even in Western Oregon, I find it interesting that we have areas now under significant restriction in terms of groundwater use. But Representative Jensen here, I have to say, is a part of the piece of Oregon geography that have the most severe restrictions on groundwater use that our agency has put in place. And so those orange areas are critical groundwater areas. These are areas where we not only do not allow new groundwater appropriation, but we have ratcheted back what folks could legally use under existing rights to, in many cases, 10 to 15% of what their water right would have otherwise allowed them. As you can imagine, this causes significant economic duress for those communities. In those particular areas, the situation that precipitated this action by our commission a number of years ago was related to groundwater declines of as much as 500 feet in irrigation wells in that area. So we have extremely severe restrictions in place. The areas that are not what we call critical, so the yellow areas that are a different level of classification, we generally do not allow new uses, but we don't restrict existing. And as I understand it, Mr. Chair, you've asked for a more kind of detailed briefing on groundwater at a future time, and so we'll be prepared with some more detailed information in that regard. Brenda, why don't you talk about some of the potential climate change issues we're starting to think about.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman. I'm with the Oregon Water Resources Department, and we wanted to share with you this afternoon some of the work we've been doing around climate change. Several years ago, we realized that the impacts of climate change could be significant to Oregon's water resources. So we partnered with the Climate Change Impacts Group at the University of Washington and also the University of Oregon to create some data that we could use moving forward. They put this map together for us, and what it conveys is we're looking at the parts in red here. These are the parts of Oregon that are dependent on mid-level or transition snowpack. So the red is not the snowpack itself, but it's the population centers and the agricultural lands that are dependent upon snowpack. That's their primary resource. And the reason this is important is because the climate change models are showing us that it's this snowpack that's going to be most vulnerable to climate change. This is snowpack that will likely go away or be reduced. That is to say, the precipitation may still come to us, but it will likely come as rain and not as snow. And because of that, we're going to lose some of our natural capacity to store water until the spring melting, until the spring runoff. So this is going to change the timing more than anything of the water that comes down our rivers and streams. And when it comes, it'll come faster, it'll come earlier in the year than we would normally see. And because it's moving so rapidly and not staying on the ground, there's less opportunity for it to recharge our groundwater resources. And that's also natural storage that we draw upon. So we are in danger of losing some of our natural storage, and this poses to us a public policy question that we'll need to be grappling with as a state and as the years and months go by, and that is, what are we to do? If we're going to lose some of that storage, how will we mitigate for that? How will we adapt to that situation? So this is one of the issues that's coming up. It's very much in front of our commission and our department now, and we're in conversations with our scientists and communities to continue to grapple with that public policy question.
Go ahead. Other challenges that we're attempting to deal with at this point in time, and we've done some work along these lines, obviously Oregon's projected to grow another 1 million people by 2030. And one of our significant challenges is providing the data that local jurisdictions need when they are making decisions about land development, et cetera, in terms of the carrying capacity of the water resource in those areas. And you can see that we've got some data gaps in a few spots. An issue specific to the agency is that, as you can see, we're a modest-sized agency generally, and we are at truly smaller numbers today than we were a decade ago. And so, obviously, we're attempting to do more with less, and technology has been a great boon, frankly, in that regard. We get about 6 million hits a year on our website from folks who, and these are discrete individual information gathering hits from folks that need water information. Our biggest customer are real estate agents in terms of researching the status of water rights around the state. Okay. So that has helped us to deal with the staff declines. This doesn't show the proposed budget, but that reduces staff a little bit further, as we can all imagine, in these economic times. So this agency is one that's largely dependent on general fund. You will be hearing at some point, Mr. Chair, we trust a fee bill relative to this agency or two. We have a couple proposals in for your consideration. But I think it's important to note that the Water Resources Department is largely dependent on general fund. That is unique, frankly, among natural resource agencies, most of which have more other fund or fee-based support by significant amounts than the Water Resources Department does. We do have a little piece of federal funds, and we do have a fee portfolio of about $7 million, and we do have two bills related to fee increases that we'll be asking you to consider later in this session. Some of the successes?
wanted to share with you some of the successes that we've seen. First, we have our Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative that we are in the stages of wrapping up right now. We've been working on this both internally with staff and with some external contractors over the last year. And this has provided us some really interesting tools for us to use, not only the data moving forward, but also some methodology that we've developed as part of this and some actual software tools that we'll be able to use in the years to come. The first thing that has come out of this is a statewide water demand forecast out to 2050, looking by counties, by what basins, and then also at the statewide level, and looking at how water may be used by the agricultural sectors, municipal and domestic. And so we have something that will be going up on our website shortly that folks will have access to, and it's a really nice model that has been developed so that you can actually ask some public policy questions. What if, you know, you can ask a lot of what if questions and answer them as well. And so this is something that we're using as a tool for conversation with counties. We've already had a couple of requests from counties to come in and share this model with them so that they can ask questions of themselves. Do we really need this water? If we do, and we've got a supply gap, how are we going to meet it in the future? So it's a pretty powerful tool, and we'd love to come back and share it at some point if you're interested. And the other things that are in here are an inventory of potential conservation opportunities. So we created this by putting a survey out to some of the member associations, irrigation districts, cities, counties, and getting their ideas for their own conservation opportunities moving forward. We also inventoried potential water storage sites that may come into play here in the future. As we were talking about losing our natural storage in the state, we may need to look at some storage sites. This was both above ground and below ground, and our staff went out and mapped potential sites around the state and talked to many folks, federal level, other state agency, county, local governments, and private partners to see what information and studies they have already conducted over the years so that we could become a clearinghouse for some of those potential locations. And the fourth piece of this was to provide some community grants for planning, which I'll touch upon in just a moment. Another opportunity for us and some successes moving forward is the work we're doing on underground water storage. And Oregon is actually a leader in this area, along with just a couple of other states that are really pursuing this idea as a strong potential for water storage moving forward. Our department, the Water Resources Department, works closely with Department of Environmental Quality and Department of Human Services drinking water program, specifically in underground storage, because while we're the quantity folks, they're looking very carefully at water quality underground and the public health component of water going in and coming back out again. So we have several projects up and running with regard to this underground storage. We have about a dozen limited licenses that we've provided around the state for folks who are interested in pursuing these projects and gathering some data, and we have permits out there as well. The one I wanted to point out to you this afternoon and just provide some anecdotal evidence of these successes is the city of Pendleton, who has a project that they're using. They're taking water from the Umatilla River during winter months when the flows are higher. They're running it through their municipal water treatment plant and then putting it underground in already existing municipal wells that they've had for years and whose water levels have declined. So there's actually room in there for that storage. They then pull it out later in the year when they need the water. And it's serving 60% of their water supply at this point from that stored water process. So we're very excited about that and expect that we'll see more projects like that in the future. Other successes, as I mentioned, we have two grant programs, one of them under the Water Supply and Conservation Initiative, specifically for planning. And this was for communities who were really in the very beginning of talking about community and regional water solutions. A lot of this money went towards helping folks convene and have the initial conversation with neighboring cities and counties. There's a second grant program that we've just launched in our November commission meeting, and this is for feasibility studies. When you have a project that you're working on for water supply, it goes through different project phases. One of them is feasibility. That's where you do all of your evaluation work before you ever get to construction or implementation. And you know, that's the hardest phase to get money for because you can't bond for that phase and you often can't get grant monies from other places. So this was a real need that we were hearing from water users. We supplied some of these monies. These are being used to match federal monies and other grants that are out there. And so it's a very good partnership that we've been able to forge. The last thing that I wanted to do this afternoon was provide some legislative highlights, things that you'll be hearing from us as we go throughout the session. We are talking about continuing the foundational work that we've already begun with a lot of our data and policy pieces and moving into more long-term integrated water resource planning, doing that together with our water quality partner in DEQ and other water-related agencies. You'll see the framework of what we're talking about and the kind of strategic planning that we mean in its in SB 193. We'll also be hearing much more about the Umatilla Basin Aquifer Recovery Project, which was the recipient of one of our feasibility grants and is interested in moving into the implementation stage here. We'll also be covering water use management, wave energy, and as previously mentioned, we have two fee bills that will be coming before you, and then budget. And I'll leave that there. We're happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for Brenda?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you. Can you describe what the Senate Bill 195 is, the wave energy bill?
Yes. Mr. Chair, let me try that, and then you can correct me.
Representative, essentially, the proponents of wave energy projects on the coast have run into a small statute in the body of law that we administer, our hydroelectric statute, and the Department of Justice has determined that wave energy projects is subject to Oregon's water hydroelectric statutes, which were designed for river systems rather than the ocean, and have a no harm to fish, kind of an absolute no harm to fish clause in them that says if this project will harm fish in any way, it won't go forward. Now, as you can imagine, a wave energy project in the experimental stage may catch a fish or two out there and thus come into conflict with that portion of Oregon statute. So what this bill would do is that it would, for small under 5-megawatt projects, experimental type of projects, for a limited time, would allow them to move forward and connect to the electric grid, which is something they haven't been able to do or can't do today and will not be able to do unless this bill is enacted, will allow them to connect with the grid through this testing phase so they can market some of the energy that's produced.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, and Director Ward, and Ms. Bateman. One of the things I learned when I was on the commission is the challenges of understanding engineering issues when none of us are engineers. And I think, in fact, the director's job used to be an engineering position. Because many of our decisions are based upon engineering issues mixed with legal issues, mixed with policy issues, what techniques are you going to use to try to bring us up to speed, maybe more efficiently than was the case 15 years ago when I was on the commission? Because I was, and you weren't there then, so I'm hoping that you guys have developed new tools, because it is truly challenging to understand measurement of water, flow of water, movement of water, and then put it into the context of law.
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, I think a critical issue question, because it is true the water business seems to be a covey of engineers and lawyers. It seem to be the people involved in the water business, and indeed the agency, the Oregon Water Resources Department, was once the office of the state water resource engineer. And so we continue to have a senior engineer here in the state of Oregon, Barry Norris, and I would hope at some time, Mr. Chair, you all get a chance to meet Barry in the committee setting, because I think he could bring some of the innovations that we have been working on in recent years as a result of his leadership. One of those key that we mentioned earlier, that Oregon was one of the first states to adopt, was the water availability analysis. Based on engineering principles and driven by the policy need to make a call on whether there's water available. So some of those kind of things. The more recent iterations of where our engineer's office has begun to move us towards solving some of these key policy science questions has been the Oregon Water Supply and Conservation Initiative that Brenda described briefly And as she described, I think we have a really good tool developed as a result of our engineers' leadership for evaluating water resource needs and potential solutions in the future. And then the last piece I'd mention is Oregon's leadership in this underground storage issue. Oregon is third in the nation in terms of implementing this new way of storing water in terms of number of projects underway in our state. We follow Florida and New Jersey. And so that's a fairly phenomenal thing for a small state like our own, and it directly has to do with the commitment of our engineering staff under Barry's leadership to try and look forward and see what the opportunities are and inch us into ways to meet them.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director Ward and Ms. Bates. My question is quite similar to Representative Bent's. I'm curious, you mentioned beneficial use without waste. I'm curious if that's a moving target over time as technology changes with ability to irrigate with various systems or use water in different ways. Does then the measurement of what is beneficial and what is wasteful change over time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that's an interesting question. And I think there are certainly differing opinions on what waste is. And so I guess I would have to acknowledge that there has been adjustment over time. And probably we look harder at that issue today than we did a decade ago as water supplies become more and more scarce. So, but I think you would hear from folks that would assert we don't look hard enough at the waste issue today, and that's something that we're having to adjust our thinking on a yearly basis on that issue and evaluate how to eliminate waste in a practical manner that doesn't harm the legitimate use of the resource but still protects the resource for other users, both in-stream and out.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions. The first one you may have already answered. And that is, what do we do particularly well? And you already said a bunch of things we do particularly well, so maybe we don't, and I mean sort of from an agency perspective as well as from a state perspective. Second, maybe a more germane question, what are the three things, pick a different number if you want, that we don't do particularly well that we need to improve? And then third and last, where is a good place for some young whippersnapper to get good information in addition to the agency to help evaluate some of these questions? We'll be hearing from a lot of folks with important interests who are, you know, lobbying us and motivating us to do certain things, and other agencies with interests. But where are good places to go for good information?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so to take your last question first,
yeah.
I think there are a number of good sources of information, both on the status of Oregon's water resource and issues surrounding it in our university system. The Institute for Water and Watersheds at Oregon State University, there are water emphasis areas, the new climate change research program that is being implemented in the university system. We are delighted to be able to see our efforts focus here in the Oregon University system rather than going to Washington for some of the information we need. So I would say our university systems, and we can help direct you to specific places, Representative, when you have the need, has some great sources of information. There's also a tremendous amount of water resource policy history active in this building, both on this committee. Your committee administrator and I have been around longer probably than we would both care to admit working these issues. But here in the room today are some tremendous sources of water resource policy information that I think you'll have opportunity to utilize. In terms of what can we do better, gosh, you hate to admit those things, but Representative, I think one of the things that Oregon has not been perhaps as aggressive as some of our neighboring states on in the past is the supply development issue. And I think that's part of that's been because we have seen ourselves as a water-rich state. The positive news there is that the Umatill Aquifer Recovery Project proposal, which the governor identifies in his budget to allocate $2.5 million to begin first phase implementation of a large-scale aquifer recovery project there in Umatilla County. That's an example of things that we need to do more of, in my view, here in the state. The other thing we need to do also is to fully account for, acknowledge, and protect the key environmental values that are tied to our water resources in this state. And that's something that Oregon has led on. So I can proudly say that we are ahead of our neighboring states in that regard. However, as we begin to move to the development of winter water resources, we have to ensure that key environmental values are protected, and we need to make sure we're doing that.
Any other questions for the department?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When it comes to the injection of water for deep storage, aquifer storage, are we doing that? Are we, is the department advising folks on public and private land, or both, or one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, excellent question. The answer is yes. And again, in Representative Jensen's neighborhood, he has a couple of what I would characterize as early adopters in terms of this technology, not just in the public sector in his neighborhood, but in the private sector. And some of the key leaders that have helped make this large-scale agricultural project move in the Umatilla Basin are private individuals that have invested literally hundreds of thousands, in some cases, of their own resources to try this technology out on their own farms to see if it works, and have kind of led the way for the additional work we've been able to complete under a grant from that you all authorized in 2008. So very definite private sector involvement, Representative.
Thanks.
Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. Director Ward, the word change and water law don't fit well. That's been my observation. And I guess if we watched what's been going on in the Klamath, that would be a good illustration. I don't know how many years that's been going on, and I have no idea how many tens of millions of dollars have now been spent. But perhaps you could share with us your thought on how change could be more correctly effected and maybe more efficiently managed. Are there lessons that we could have learned or should have learned from that exercise?
Mr. Chair, Representative, a challenging question there. In my view, Oregon water law can best be adjusted incrementally, and that we need to look at adjustments in this very large, complicated, and historic, as you know, body of law in pieces. And wholesale adjustments to this body of law, I think, will be met with significant resistance, because there are significant losers from that kind of approach. So I think the approach we're trying to take with the Commission today and in the proposals that you will see us bring to you during the session are what we would consider modest adjustments to a body of law that has a lot of stakeholders very deeply engaged in its management. Now, the good news, in my view, Representative, is that we have been able to make modest adjustments. Some of those came during the time of your leadership on the Commission, where innovations have occurred that have worked over the long haul and have been of benefit both to the resource and to the user community. So it would be my view that we need to continue to look for those kind of incremental adjustments as we seek to improve this body of law.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad that you mentioned in your response to Representative Smith's question the Climate Change Research Institute. We're hoping to get and planning to get its new director before this committee in short order, as well as OSU's Institute for Water and Watersheds, and look forward to hearing about their work as well. So those are two of the resources that you mentioned that I think we'll also be hearing from in this setting, and appreciate, of course, your leadership and good work since we last seen you, and to continue. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'll invite Neil Mullane from the Department of Environmental Quality.
Thank you. was going to...
It should be on there.
It should be on there?
Can you...
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Neil Mullane, and I'm the administrator of the Water Quality Program for the state of Oregon. And with me is Christine Spekovich. She works in the department as my policy analyst in the water program. And we were asked to come today to kind of give you an overview of really the impact of the Clean Water Act on the operation of the department, what we do as a result of the Clean Water Act. And I'm going to go through a number of different areas that we implement and that we're responsible for as a result of the Clean Water Act, and give you some information on some additional programs that we work with. If you're familiar with the Clean Water Act, it's one of the most comprehensive pieces of federal legislation back in the 70s to deal with environmental issues. And when I say comprehensive, it went from the smallest stream down through the rivers, lakes, estuaries, out to the ocean, and dealing with wetlands. So as we have a department deal with the Clean Water Act, there are very specific things within the Clean Water Act that are delegated to the state to work on, and then things that are delegated to the federal agency, that is EPA, which then in turn can, in fact, delegate to the department to do. And I'll cover a few of those things. We don't have time to kind of go through the entire act and all the different programs, so what I did was identify some of the very key and significant elements of the Clean Water Act that the department implements. And this is a list of things that I pulled out, and I'm more than welcome as we go through if you want questions on other elements of the act, we can address those also. But obviously standards, setting up standards for the state, very important. Assessing the quality of the waters in the state, having a permit program that basically identifies who can discharge and what they can discharge, compliance with the Act, compliance with the various permits, development of total maximum daily loads, and I'll get into that in a little bit later into some detail as to what that is, state revolving fund, that is the ability for us to assist in paying for some of the infrastructure that we're asking people to build to treat the waste from sanitary sewers. And then non-point source grant program, again, an ability to provide some funding to look at some restoration activities within the non-point source area. To get a little bit more into detail on this, when you look at the Clean Water Act, the standards really are the foundation or the backbone of the Act. And when you look at a water quality program, it's really the standards that provide us the ability to do things. That is what we are regulating to achieve. And the standards have two key components in them when you set up a water quality standards. The first of those is to identify the beneficial uses for the waters of the state that you're in. And in Oregon, when we first started this effort back in the early 70s, we actually turned to the Water Resources Department and said, okay, in your water resources plans, what do you have in terms of identification of beneficial uses in Oregon? So when we started out in this program, we were very joined at the hip with Water Resources and identifying what the beneficial uses of water in the state were. Once you have those beneficial uses identified throughout the state for all the basins, you then identify what the criteria, that is the numeric criteria, that you would have to reach and meet in order to protect those uses. So if you have a use that includes fisheries and you need to keep the water at a certain temperature in order to protect that use, you identify throughout the state where that particular fishery use is and what the temperature needs to be in order to protect that use. And those are the two components of a standard. So in Oregon, looking at Section 303 of the Act, we go through the Act, we identify what we need to do in terms of establishing standards as a department. Then we bring those standards to the State Commission, the Environmental Quality Commission, and ask for adoption. The Commission then, once they adopt those, we have to actually submit those to EPA for review and approval. And once they're approved, we can then use them within the Clean Water Act programs that we have at the Department, and they actually, in essence, become the federal standards for the state of Oregon. Now, the way the Act was set up is they didn't want to have nationwide standards for everybody because waters are different as you cross the nation, and they wanted each of the states to really develop their own standards, to really say in their state, for their waters, these are the standards that they want to have. And now, if a state doesn't act and doesn't implement the standards, then EPA is the fallback agency to actually develop standards for a particular state. After you have the standards, obviously one of the key things in the Act that they wanted people to do and the states to do was to assess their water bodies, looking at the water bodies and seeing, are you actually meeting those water quality standards? Do you have water bodies that are exceeding those standards, or are they better than those standards? And get a good picture as to what actually is the quality of water throughout the entire state. So the Act in Section 305 requires the state every 2 years to take all the information that they've gathered and look at that information and really assess what is the quality of waters in the state. And then Oregon has been doing that for a number of years. One key subset of that particular report is what we call as the 303D list. And that's the identification of water bodies that are not meeting those standards and are not protecting those beneficial uses. And the key thing here is when we identify those, we then are required to go and essentially develop specific standards for that particular parameter that's not meeting the standard, and reduce the amount of load of pollutants that go into the stream. And I'll cover that again in here in a minute because it's integral to the program itself. A couple of the permit areas that are specific to us. The first one is under Section 401. I think a lot of people are familiar with Section 401, but it's the water quality certification section of the Act. And it's one of those pieces of federal legislation that I'm not sure is repeated very often, but it gives the state the ability to review federal projects and federal licenses and to determine whether or not that particular action in that federal license is in fact going to meet water quality standards for the state of Oregon. So DEQ receives these federal licenses, reviews them, and determines whether or not the particular action in that particular license will in fact meet the water quality standards. And if it isn't, we can deny that certification and that particular project doesn't go forward, or we can condition it with identification of what we feel needs to happen in order for that particular activity to occur and meet the water quality standards for the state of Oregon. And if you're familiar with the 404 permit program by the Corps of Engineers, which has a number of activities for removal and fill, this is where DEQ intersects with that and actually reviews those permits and identifies which ones of those will, in fact, meet the water quality standards for the state of Oregon. The next one there is Section 402, which is the major permit program that is embodied within the Clean Water Act. And the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System is actually delegated to EPA, and EPA then can turn around and delegate that program to the states. And Oregon, in this particular region, Oregon is one of the states that is delegated to run the National Permit Program. And again, this program is set up where we issue permits that have to require the sources that are discharging meet the water quality standards for the state of Oregon. So if you have an industry or a city that has a treatment system and that they're discharging to waters of the state, that permit has to set limits within the permit that requires that facility to meet the water quality standards for the state of Oregon. Okay? The TMDL program, and the reason why I put it again here is the TMDL program sets, again, a second level of standards, you could say. They identify specific limits that those permittees may, in fact, have to meet, different than the water quality standards that we have. And in the state of Oregon, we're under a federal consent decree to develop a certain number of those TMDLs, or that is identifying for specific water bodies in the state the total maximum daily load for those particular water bodies, and we're on a course to meet our consent decree. We just submitted our last round of TMDLs we developed last year to EPA, and we're beginning anew this year on a new set of TMDLs. And the reason I put the number in there is we're on this deadline, and each year we have to complete so many of them in order to be in compliance with the consent decree. And finally, I have there is the non-point source program, which is under Section 319 of the Act. Money is actually allocated to the states through EPA to provide some funding for basic projects in the agriculture area, or I should say the non-point source area, to do restoration activities. And we receive approximately about $3 million of biennium to allocate out and for projects. And we are just now completing, or I should say beginning the review, but completing the intake in this year's applications for that particular grant program. The next one is the State Revolving Loan Fund Program, which is under Section 602. And under this program, the federal government does provide cap grants to the states to provide some funding under a loan program to the cities to basically build the infrastructure for the wastewater treatment plants that we needed. The one thing I would point out here is when the Act was first written, this was a grant program. And this is, you know, back in the 70s and in the 80s, this is where a tremendous amount of work was done in the state of Oregon to build sewage treatment plants. And it was built with grant funding. Right now, we're at the point where a lot of those particular facilities are basically aging. And we're faced with a lot of infrastructure needs in the state of Oregon, particularly for small communities, trying to keep up with their facilities and what is happening to those facilities. But this grant program, this loan program has some ability to provide funding to the cities for that. And as you can see there, we've basically since 1987 is when it switched from a grant program to a loan program, about $708 million have been loaned out in that program. One caveat I'd add to this is that we are hearing that with the stimulus package, there may be an extra shot of money coming into this program that we're trying to prepare for and prepare the cities for and the consultants for, that we may actually receive a big slug of money that we need to kind of facilitate and loan out to people within a very short period of time.
Question, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. So if your understanding is that if you were to get a money from the federal stimulus program, it would be money to be lent and not grants?
Sure, Cannon, Representative. I think that is still undecided.
Okay.
There's been a lot of discussion as to whether or not to could earmark a certain portion of it for grants and the rest as a cap.
Follow-up, if I may. Well, it's a two-part question. Do we have projects which are ready to go, but for the funding, either as grant funding or as loans?
Representative Cannon, Chair Cannon. The department puts a solicitation out every year for projects.
Right.
And our current list, I believe, is about $190 million. But those are projects or applications that are come in that we're reviewing, and there's still work to be done on those to actually move them over to, say, shovel-ready.
Mm-hmm.
But so there is a number of projects, say, in the queue that we can move over to shovel-ready if, in fact, we work on, you know, cleaning up some of those applications. This particular funding could be used for those projects, and we could use our normal, you know, annual allotment for the program for those.
All right. And another follow-up, if I may. One of the things I'm aware of, having watched Coburg in its process, is the difficulty both obtaining the dollars at all to do the construction and then to have them come in a way that keeps the cost of debt service to a level that businesses and homeowners can actually afford. It would seem to me, and I have to tell you, I don't know enough of the details of the Coburg plan to know how important this is, but it seems to me it would make a big difference in the case of some projects as to whether funds are available to be lent or whether they become grants, because that has a huge impact, or could have a huge impact, on the monthly service charges that are charged for wastewater. I wonder if there's a difference in terms of what might be ready based on that consideration.
Yeah. Chair Cannon, Representative, what we have tried to do is really identify for communities some of those difficulties. I mean,
yeah,
we have communities out there that definitely, I mean, I could name several of them because I used to work directly with a lot of those communities on the granting and loan programs. And even if the money is there, do they have the bonding capacity to actually go out and actually receive the money and actually work with it. And that is one of the concerns that we have, and that's why we've been talking with the cities and working on whether or not to move forward with some pressure or letters to say, hey, let's try to look at this as a grant program also, because there are some communities, even if the money is there, they're not going to be able to take advantage of the stimulus package, and some of those communities are the ones that you actually would like to see move forward with some construction in the area and actually revitalize that particular community.
And you would like to see that because of the effect it has on water quality?
And also locally in the economy in the area. Some of these are very hard-pressed communities.
Great.
Representative Gill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just following up on that just for a second, if you just say a little bit more. When you say there's been discussions, is that here, or are we talking to the feds yet about this in terms of the stimulus package? And then secondly, if we are trying to get shovel-ready lists ready, is it your job to prioritize those, and are they, as they come in, prioritized based on timing, importance, whatever your criteria?
Okay. Chair Cannon, to answer your first question, we are in the discussions to the point with the cities that we're supposed to be meeting next week and basically outlining the letter and writing the letter that we'd send back to the congressional delegation, making the points about, you know, is there a possibility of percent of the particular stimulus that could be loans or grants, and could we get that out sooner? So I think there's a lot of work and discussions that have been going on to actually try to get that out there to do that. And it just slipped my mind a second question.
Well, I just want to know more about the prioritizing of your shovel-ready.
When a project comes in, the initial screening does, we go through a process of ranking those projects, and we have a point system that's set out in our rules, and we identify, you know, those for that particular project and application where it falls within that. But the next step is to make sure you have a completed application. So they come in and we rank them all, and then our project officers work on people based on that rank. But what we're trying to do is get those particular applications completely finished. So for the most part, they come in with work still needing to be done. And the next step is to move them from that to shovel-ready. There's no priority for shovel-ready. It's when we can get these things done and move them to that list, they're ready to go. And the money comes in and we have loans, we can go out and put them out to those particular projects. And that's one of the things we had the cities in and their consultants in about a month ago now, probably. I think it was on December 15th, where we brought as many as we could in, and a lot of the people that were on that list, and really tried to impress upon them the need to get the applications finished, that we have them in the door, let's get back and make sure you have a completed application so we're ready to go, and move as many as we can from that $190 million over to the ready list so they could be to fund it. But again, to get back to the previous questions, a lot of those communities still need some help because they don't necessarily have the bonding capacity or the revenue locally to actually take the project, even if the money was there as a loan. So we have to work on that.
Great. Thank you.
I wanted to highlight a couple of the areas that we're working specifically with the agencies that you'll be talking to today. And obviously in the drinking water program there is a direct tie-in with DEQ and the work that we're doing in terms of water quality. And we have several different areas that we work with the Health Division. And one of those is to look at the source water area for the drinking water systems, to help them identify, and the communities identify, if there's any potential sources of contamination in those areas, and then work with them on TA, and that is trying to assist them in how to address those particular potential contaminant problems. Also, when I mentioned standards earlier, we have a lot of committees set up that we're working on development of water quality standards, and we invite the Health Division to be a part of that so they can work with us in terms of what is going on in the health arena and for us to develop those particular standards. With water resources, and Phil stole a lot of my thunder here because I think he's mentioned every one of these, but DEQ, in terms of working water resources, we also review at their request. They send out to us the water right applications, and we give it a water quality review. We also have put together rules for procedures for the department to actually apply for the in-stream water rights that Phil mentioned earlier. Implementation of the groundwater management areas. There was a state groundwater protection act that was passed that basically sets up a mechanism where we can declare areas as management areas that have water contamination issues within the aquifers, and then work with the communities in those areas to see if we can't actually turn that around and reserve those aquifers and clean those up. And there's three of them in the state of Oregon, those areas. And in those areas, we work directly with water resources on the work that we're doing. Recycled water. This is one of the main areas that we've been working on in the last couple of years. And recycled water is looking at the effluent from a wastewater treatment plant, where we've treated that effluent, we're getting it to a level of treatment that we can actually then turn around and use that for various beneficial uses. And we work with the water resources then where that can occur and how it can occur. And the next one there is the, again, Phil stole it, is the ASR and the working with the aquifer storage and recovery. We have specifically people on our staffs that work directly with water resources on the water quality issues and trying to resolve any issues and review the data that a particular potential project might have about the water that they're going to take and put into the groundwater. And finally, the TMDL water and the clean water plans. The TMDL, when you're establishing and setting up, one of the key factors within there is the flow within the stream. So as we're modeling the TMDLs and trying to figure out how much pollutant load can go into those water bodies, we're specifically looking at what is the flow within the stream. So we have a very key tie-in with Water Resources Department on the flow. Just touch very briefly on this. We have two areas that I think you'd be interested in. Is we have a package in legislation in terms of the 401 program I mentioned earlier. We currently have about half of the people who are coming to us for review and approval paying a fee, and the other half do not. And we've certainly heard some interesting discussion on why we're not actually charging everybody that comes to us for that particular service. So the package is really to look at how we could really set up an equitable fee program for everybody that comes for that 401 review. And then again, Brenda mentioned earlier, is the integrated water resource strategy program.
Great. Well, if there are no final questions, I appreciate your time and presentation and also your help with the bill that comes out of our interim Energy and Environment Committee that we'll be hearing on Tuesday. I hope that you'll be able to make that public hearing. It's a bill related to water reuse and reuse of gray water coming out of homes, and appreciate the work you've done to help ensure that bill would work for the agency, and look forward to seeing you then.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Gail Shibley, DHS, and Dave Leland.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. First, it's a delight and a privilege to be here. I particularly recognize the new chair. Congratulations and best wishes to all of you on this committee. A very important work, as you all indicated. I'm glad, once again, you saved the best for last. We're going to spice things up here. What I'd like to do is just take a couple minutes and set a broader context here, give you a quick 1-2 in terms of who in the heck I am and why I'm here when you're really just talking about engineering and water kinds of stuff. What is this Department of Human Services doing here, for heaven's sakes? And then we're going to take a big splash into a very important issue of drinking water. My office is one of five offices that makes up the Public Health Division. Public Health Division is one of five or six divisions within the Department of Human Services. My office, our mission is really helping Oregonians be safe from environmental hazards, and we do that in a couple, three ways, grossly stated. One is really quality assurance and oversight. Another is information and education, and a third is risk assessment, the kind of scientific tracking and work and surveillance and toxicological, epidemiological assessments that are part of that. My office is kind of organized in four different areas: radiation protection services, food pool and lodging, toxicology assessment and tracking, and Mr. Leland's drinking water program. Dave Leland is the manager of our drinking water program, and I think he was. Maybe he started the program when the first drop of drinking water was. No, he jokes sometimes about how long he's been at this. But I tell you, I'd be lost without him. Drinking water really uses all three of those areas that I mentioned: the quality assurance, the information education, and the risk assessment. The other areas, when it comes to water, anyway, we don't have regulatory oversight. We use mostly information, education, and minimally, depending on this rather creative resources we're able to bring to bear, periodically we're able to do some risk assessments around that. My office has round numbers about $44 million of biennium in total funds. That's general, other, and federal funds. About 120, 125 people, and about 100 different funding sources. So, we talk about funding streams. I used to talk about funding rivulets. Mr. Leland calls them buckets because they're phases of grants that come in, and managing the different phases and the carryovers and so on is rather makes for some good fiscal gymnastics at times. That $44 million includes about $5 million of general fund. So, I don't want to say that's it, but that is the sum total, and a little bit less of general fund. About more than $7 million of fees of other funds for a whole bunch of things, and we can talk about any of those at any point. And about $32 million or so in federal funds. That's where the sweet spot is, so to speak. That's about more than 80% of my budget is federal dollars. That includes about $22 million a biennium, about $11 million a year in the state revolving fund, which comes to the state. That's the drinking water piece of, or sister, if you will, to Neil's clean water state revolving fund. And with those dollars that we get, we help provide dollars to local communities to do the kind of capital construction to make sure that the operators can, in fact, deliver safe drinking water. And we've lent about $150 million since its inception after the 96 Federal Act to about 80 communities around the state. So how do we deal with water within my office as a whole? Well, in food pool and lodging, the pool piece of that are all of the community swimming pools that we see from across the street, the sprays and the wading pools to the YMCAs and the other kinds of public pools. Our toxicology and assessment and tracking area, they deal with some really knotty issues that really Oregon and I might say public health have really been leaders in. The biggest one right now is a hazardous algal blooms. Blue-green algae, cyanobacteria blooms have been increasing in duration and toxicity. They've been starting earlier in the year. They've been lasting longer in the fall, and they have been of increasing toxicity. We have just a fairly new federal grant to begin to put together some really next stage of surveillance to gather the data to make thoughtful, intelligent decisions on how to deal with this. Gray water is another piece where we don't have particular regulatory oversight, but we work very closely. Our toxicologists and epidemiologists work with DEQ and provide that kind of technical assistance. Climate change, and Brenda mentioned this in one comment, at least from WRD, we don't deal so much in public health with climate change mitigation, but we need to be prepared as a public health system, local and state system, in adapting to the climate disruptions of increasing frequency and severity and duration. And certainly we're familiar with flooding events and how disruptive that can be, not only for transportation, but for drinking water, the boil water notices and the danger to the water, drinking water intakes and so on. Droughts and heat events, forest fires, other kinds of climatic conditions and disruptions have a human health impact to that, both acute as well as chronic. And I won't dwell on all of that here since we're focusing specifically on water, but I wanted to call that to your attention. And rounding out that thought, I really appreciate the recognition and the discernment of this committee in making sure that public health is a part of these broader resource discussions. It is biologically impossible for us to maintain a healthy population of Oregonians in an unhealthy environment. And we simply cannot get there through individual medical interventions, as laudatory as they all are and as terrific as the state of the science is in healthcare and medical provisions these days. It is the fundamental basis, and it is the reason why our infant mortality is such and our life expectancies are what they are in the modern world today. It is because of environmental human health protection. And so I really appreciate your recognition and leadership in that regard. So who the heck cares about water? Well,
it's the up and down here.
Okay. You know, I have to say, I think it was Representative Jensen, as only he can say, that that people who make bourbon care about water, and people who make lattes and pinots and pints and lots of other things we do here in Oregon, we care about water. It's certainly the source of life, and we get an awful lot of help in trying to make some of these tough decisions about where we focus our resources and the kinds of help that is needed. Where do we get our drinking water? Depending on how you slice it, about 60-40 is surface water, groundwater. The larger communities, of course, need the volume of water that really only surface water can provide. Bull Run, of course, being the big example of that. But even here in Salem, very small systems are those that are not regulated by the federal EPA. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act is where we get our dollars, both for the revolving fund as well as for what's called primacy, where we are responsible for assuring safe drinking water of these larger systems. And when I say larger, they're 15 connections or more. It's not large, it's just 15 or more. ORS 448 provides that 4 to 14 connection systems also meet those same standards as the EPA regulated systems. And then the individual home wells, we really don't regulate. I think I'm told from Mr. Leland that we used to back in the day, but that effort has been gone now for more than a decade or so. Phil and his crew at WRD make sure that the wells are constructed according to the various regulations. We do have one small piece, which I am hopeful that you will be having an opportunity to consider a bill here later on this session. But current law requires that when you have a domestic well attached to a piece of property, that when you sell that property, the seller of that property has to get that well tested for nitrates and total coliforms and provide us the information so that we can at least theoretically take some action and have better understanding of what's the state of the water quality amongst these private wells.
Galen, I want to note that we have about 10 minutes left.
Okay.
To see you, but
okay.
Presentation is still to give.
Well, so we've got, as you see there, we've got literally thousands of water systems, and overwhelming number of them are small systems. We've got, as I said, everything from Bull Run to the campground drinking fountain or spigot at the Forest Service campground. What do we look at and what do we care about? There are 91 contaminants that are regulated under the federal EPA, and they're getting more and more complex, and we think appropriately so. Understandably enough, they're focused an awful lot on microbial to get at the bugs in the water, because those are the acute diseases that are connected to them. You see the list here that's kind of 2 through 6. Those are some of the contaminants that we find in the water that have chronic effects. It's not as though when you drink them you're going to get nauseous and sick, but there's a reason that they are there in terms of the contaminant list, and we're concerned about them, and we want to make sure you understand that they're there as well. We have, thanks to your support and leadership in the last legislative session, we got some additional resources, and we have been moving very assiduously to focus on these specific items here, and make sure that whatever system that is subject to our oversight gets the kind of attention and focus that it needs, regardless of the size, regardless of the location. Because of the small systems, oftentimes these are folks who, these are public utilities that could be a retired couple living in a mobile home park, a manufactured housing park, or it could be, another small facility. They don't have the kind of big environmental engineers that the city of Portland has, or that city of Salem, Medford, Bend, and so on. And so we are very focused on making sure that these folks have the kind of assistance that they need. And so to that end, that really is what we have been dealing with. We know we've got more to do, and yet we know we've made some significant progress. I was just upstairs in the legislative library, and I saw the headline from March, I want to say it's 1st, 2008, happened to be in the Oregonian, and it was a grabber headline that didn't quite match the story, but it said, drinking water sources found tainted, or something like that, and it had to do with an issue that I'll get to here in about two sentences. We've been doing fairly well. We have an Oregon benchmark. Is it 64, 69? Oregon benchmark 69 that looks at both the number of Oregonians that have been served that meet health with systems that meet health-based standards, and also the percentage of systems that meet the health-based standards. And we've been bouncing up and down around 80% on that systems level, compared with, as you see, 95% or so on the population. And so that's another trigger that tells us that it's the smaller systems that struggle to meet, reliably meet all of these standards that we've got. So we've got, as I said, some even new additional rules, and in fact, in the next coming weeks, or excuse me, months, we're adopting just three new rules that we call phone book rules, that we, thanks to you, we now have capacity to take on. We also have a statutory drinking water advisory committee that represents all of these stakeholders. We think that's particularly important because last I checked, everybody, just about everybody drinks water. I mentioned a bill that I'm hopeful that you'll be seeing. Arsenic testing from domestic wells. What we'd like to do is add arsenic to that list of total coliform and nitrates. We know that arsenic is a concern all over the state, and we need to dealing with it. The contaminants of emerging concern I want to highlight for you as well. That really was what that headline that I mentioned from last March was about. Technology is a wonderful thing, and what used to be non-detects 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, are now hits, particularly with USGS and other very finely tuned instrumentation that they have. Parts per trillion, parts per quadrillion. What does that mean? Well, we don't particularly know. We work an awful lot with our colleagues around the country, read the latest scientific literature. What we would like to do is to, clearly, we get to and we have to and we're committed to making sure that the 91 or however many EPA contaminants are covered, but we need to make sure that water, drinking water safety is zeroed in on what's happening here in Oregon. And so with some of those additional dollars that we got last legislative session, partnership with DEQ, we went out and looked at 6 surface water and 6 groundwater sites around the state to literally see what's in the water. And we didn't pretend to scan it for absolutely everything that might be out there, but we took a very broad sweep, and we're just now vetting the data that have come in from those that monitoring. We want to use that to really make sure that we are paying attention to the contaminants that are out there, whatever they might be, whether and whatever their sources might be. We are agnostic. We're not about trying to beat up industry or beat up agriculture or beat up urbanites or anybody else. We care about the human body and the completed exposure pathway of contaminant X to human system Y, and trying to minimize the threats that might come about as a result of that. So that's where we hope to be able to go, and wanted to highlight that for you. Last but not least, the climate change piece. As I said, water is really front and center for us. We are in the midst now of applying for some federal dollars that we are hopeful for that would give us some funding for the next couple years to really work with local health departments and make sure that we've got the plans and the options in place so that if we've got flooding here and landslides here and other supply disruptions and distribution disruptions, that we know what to do about it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your presentation, Gail. And as you monitor those water supplies for emerging contaminants, I hope if there are areas of concern. I mean, if you reach that conclusion about the evidence that you've gathered, you'll consider coming back to this committee with some possible information and possible suggestions. Before we close the committee, are there any quick questions for DHS? Yeah,
I'm not sure this is a question as much as an observation. I'm still learning about water. And it occurs to me, having these three presentations together, which may have been, Mr. Chair, your plan today, that these efforts all sort of dovetail. If you examine the water coming out of a well on a farm downstream from Coburg, you're very likely to find organic materials in the well water. Because of the fact that Coburg doesn't have a sewer system and everything is used is groundwater fed. So it occurs to me that a big chunk of water quality depends upon prevention, actually preventing things from going into the groundwater in the first place in the case of those kind of wells. And I suspect a whole bunch of the other things you're working on are really ways of signaling where we need to do a better job of prevention upstream, if you will, from the place where you're actually sampling water. Would that be a fair assessment as we look at this whole, at your department being a piece of a much larger system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, you're singing my song, and actually the song of public health, which is all about prevention. And, you know, some wise philosopher said one man's ceiling is another man's floor. And that's certainly true, whether it's drinking water or anything else. And we are very concerned about some of these dynamics that we see with nothing but goodwill and opportunity on all sides between our agencies. It can be a little challenging to make sure that public health fully engages to the amount, whether it's, you mentioned, I believe, land use and transportation being so importantly connected. We're familiar in Oregon with land use, transportation, and air quality. I would posit to you, as I have many times to others, that there is a very strong connection between land use, transportation, and water quality. And you're absolutely right. Garbage in, garbage out, and you can either protect the drinking water sources through a relatively minor and modest kind of investment, or you can try to engineer your way out at the end of the pipe, so to speak, and get out all of these contaminants, which frankly we don't know how to get out, and to very questionable effect. So I appreciate you raising that issue. It's a very important one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Just a quick question. Is it like, how do you decide where to take these? Are they arbitrary test sites? Or are you reacting to a complaint or something's wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, let me see if I can quickly but accurately answer that very important question. The 6 and 6 that we did was really a one-time deal. It's not like a part of an ongoing, if somebody calls in with a complaint, then we'll go out and test. Unfortunately, I wish we might have a little more predictability than that. But it was in consultation with our colleagues at DEQ and really trying to identify. We wanted urban and rural in different parts of the state, different types of topography, different types of soils and aquifers, and different types of land uses, etc. We have done a series of, again, with our colleagues at DEQ, a series of source water assessments for public water systems around the state and provided the report to the local communities so that they take a look at what is the source water aquifer for their municipal water supply, what's the kind of two-year time of travel, literally a concentric circle, if you will, almost, and then what are the attendant land uses within those areas, and what are the possible environmental hazards that could be attendant to those land uses, whether it's a gas station or a dry cleaners or a farm or, you know, et cetera. And so there is, in this case, it was us taking a look at all of those systems, literally thousands of them, and in the 13 basins around the state, and trying to identify where can we get a representative sampling, modest though it is. And I'm happy to, I absolutely commit to making sure that you're informed of any noteworthy. We do anticipate the data coming out in the coming weeks, so certainly we'll give you a preview of it in any case.
Great. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you later in the session. I appreciate you being here today and your work in this important subject. I mean, we see the connections between all of these topics, and I do hope that today's presentations helped kind of illustrate some of them. So thank you very much. With that, I'll close the hearing of the Environment and Water Committee. Thanks.